Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today's episode is titled Great Women of Music. We are discussing the influential female musicians of history, particularly the composers. In the first half, we discussed a few female composers from the Baroque and classical eras, as well as one from the Romantic era. We'll continue our discussion now of the Romantic era and talk about another great female composer. We just discussed Fanny Mendelssohn, sister of the well-known Felix Mendelssohn. The next composer we'll discuss was also related to a famous composer of that time period, this time by marriage. Her name was Clara Schumann. She was known as a remarkable performer and composer of the 19th century, sometimes called Europe's Queen of the Piano. She was born Clara Wieck into a middle-class family in Leipzig, Germany, and lived from 1819 to 1896. Her father was a piano teacher, and her mother was a concert pianist, even while she was raising five children. Though her parents divorced while she was still young, they both had a great deal of influence over her musically. Clara had begun taking piano lessons from her father before her parents divorced. He recognized a lot of potential in her, so he devoted himself to making her great. She benefited from his progressive teaching methods, which emphasized quality of practice over quantity. Additionally, she was enrolled in music theory and composition with the top teachers available in Leipzig. She gave her first full recital at age 11 in Leipzig, but 2 years later she had performed in the famous Gewandhaus Concert Hall. While still quite young, she met the man who would become her husband, Robert Schumann. They met when he began taking lessons from her father and rented a room in the family home. Robert Schumann and Clara Wieck played piano together, studied other composers together, and exchanged compositional ideas. It was only a matter of time. Robert always encouraged her to compose, and he arranged for her music to be published. He would sometimes quote musical phrases from her compositions in his own works. During the 1840s and 1850s, Clara Schumann composed some of her best music and toured as a pianist. In 1846, she wrote what might be considered her greatest work, the Piano Trio in G minor. While her husband's health was deteriorating in the 1850s, she wrote her three romances for the violin and piano. There are passages of deep sadness in those works, no doubt a result of her situation at the time. And after her husband died, Clara Schumann stopped composing almost entirely, but grew as a concert pianist. After moving to Berlin in 1857, she became known as one of the elite musicians of the German capital, touring from England all the way to Russia. She continued as a touring musician until just 5 years before her death in 1896. We're going to hear a movement of that famed piano trio in G minor. And a piano trio, by the way, is not three pianos, but it usually implies a piano, a violin, and a cello. This is the first out of the four movements. Here it is performed by pianist Michaela Gelius, violinist Sreten Kristic, and cellist Stefan Hock. Thank you. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Great Women of Music, and we are exploring the influential female composers. That was the first movement of the piano trio in G minor by Clara Schumann, which is considered one of her greatest compositions. Clara Schumann was a great composer in her own right, but she also musically impacted her husband and the couple's younger friend, one Johannes Brahms, who took care of Clara after she was widowed. Another great female composer who stands out in music history was also a remarkable musician from an extremely young age. To say she was a child prodigy doesn't quite do it justice, though. At age one, she could hum 40 songs from memory. At age two, she could improvise counterpoint or harmony to songs her mother would sing. At age three, she taught herself to read, and it is believed she was composing to some degree by age four. Her name was Amy Marcy Cheney, but we remember her by her married name, Amy Beach. Amy was born in New Hampshire in 1867, so not only were female composers somewhat a rarity at this time, so were great American composers. Her mother, Clara Cheney, was a talented pianist and singer. She picked up on Amy's musical proclivities. Apparently, little Amy would fuss if her mother sang a song in a different key from what she had originally learned. Amy was quite a strong-willed child, and she desperately wanted to play the piano. However, her mother did not want her to tire of her gift by letting her overindulge in it. So being forbidden from touching the piano, Amy would play the songs she heard her mother play in her head while drumming on a table. Amy's aunt, on the other hand, was not so strict, and during a visit when Amy was four, she sat her young niece at the piano and let her play. She began to play all the songs that she had been storing up in her head, having to leave out some of the notes that her little hands could not reach. After this, Clara Cheney gave her daughter limited access to the piano, controlling the amount of time that she could play each day. She would play music that she had heard before, as well as many pieces that she composed herself. At age 18, Amy married Henry Beach, a widower 25 years her senior. Her husband encouraged her to compose, and she spent the next 25 years focusing on composing a wide variety of music, including a mass in E-flat major and a symphony in E minor, nicknamed the Gaelic Symphony. Amy Beach had also performed in public, but in a somewhat limited manner, until the death of her husband in 1910, after which she toured all over America and Europe performing her own compositions. She lived to the age of 77. The piece I opened the show with was her piano quintet in F-sharp minor. Again, a piano quintet is not five pianos, but a string quartet and a piano, so five instruments total. This piano quintet was premiered in February 1908 with Amy Beach at the piano with the Hoffman String Quartet. This chamber work is only three movements. Most pieces that employ a string quartet would have four movements. So these three movements follow more of the fast, slow, fast sonata format. This was a time when music had to be infused with a great deal of emotional content. This is evident, especially in the lyrical and sublime second movement of this chamber work, and let's hear a little of this movement as well. Thank you.
Hi, I'm cellist Sarah Sanabrogio, and you are listening to Music for Life on KPCG.
So that was just a little of the lovely second movement to Amy Beach's Piano Quintet in F-sharp minor, performed by the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. As we move into the so-called modern era now, we must discuss arguably one of the most influential musicians of the 20th century. I don't think that's an overstatement, and though she was a composer, and though her compositions aren't necessarily as well known, her impact on other composers is massive. Through her career as a teacher, she had a total of over 1,200 students, among them some of the greatest composers of that century. We have talked about her and her influence on previous episodes, particularly her influence on the American composer Aaron Copland. She encouraged him to develop a uniquely American style of composing, which American composers generally hadn't done yet. As you just heard in that American composition of Amy Beach, her music sounded a lot like the German composer Johannes Brahms. The name of this composer and educator, who had such a profound impact on Aaron Copland and other composers of the 20th century, was Nadia Boulanger. She was born in 1887 and lived until 1979. Her father, Ernest Boulanger, was a composer, conductor, and professor at the Paris Conservatory. Her family associated with famous composers such as Camille Saint-Saëns, Peter Tchaikovsky, Charles Gounod, and Jules Massenet. Nadia's father retired from the conservatory in 1895 and dedicated himself to teaching his daughter. She had been studying at the conservatory for 9 years by that point. In 1901, she enrolled in a composition class taught by the famous French composer Gabriel Fauré. By 1903, she was sitting in on the class as Fauré's substitute organist. 1 year later, at age 17, Boulanger was awarded the conservatory's first prize in organ, piano accompaniment, and composition. Though we mostly hear Nadia's influence on other composers, let's hear one of her own compositions. This is a short work called Three Pieces for Cello and Piano. It's performed by cellist Nicolas Ahlstedt and pianist José Gallardo, and we'll hear the third and final piece from this set. We just heard the third of three pieces for cello and piano. This set was composed by Nadia Boulanger, one of the most influential composers and educators of the 20th century. Next, let's get into our backstage banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. We've been talking about great women of music today, and we've dwelt mostly on composers of history, but let's talk to a great performer. She is a Grammy-winning cellist who is a founding member of the world-renowned chamber ensemble, the Eroica Trio. She was just here at Armstrong Auditorium for a splendid performance of an all-Chopin program. In our interview, we cover a gamut of great topics, including her creative process as an arranger and composer, her artistic influences as a performer, and some very intriguing details about her musical family and upbringing. Please welcome to the program, Sarah Santambrogio. Your mother was your first piano teacher and your father was your cello teacher.
Yes.
I find that interesting since that parent-child slash teacher-student relationship can have some quirks or drawbacks, but it seems to have worked wonderfully for you. Can you talk about that particular teacher-student relationship that you had with your father?
You know, he was very hesitant to let me play the cello because he was worried. Both his parents had been his teachers as well. Mm. His mother, my grandmother, was a phenomenal concert pianist. And then his father was a very good violinist and violist, actually played in a string quartet with Joseph Gingold, who is Josh Bell's teacher. Mm-hmm. And Joseph Gingold was actually the best man at my grandparents' wedding. Hmm. And so my dad had studied piano with his mother and violin with his father, and it had not worked for them. Mm. And so finally he found the cello relatively late at 15. Mm. And then that's when he went great guns. And so I started on piano with my mom, but like at 2. You know, it worked just fine. It seemed normal. In my family, it seemed normal. Mm. And I just kept begging and begging and begging for a cello from the time I was 4. Finally, at 6, what happened was, because I'm kind of petite, and when I was, my mom took me to the shoe store to get school shoes for first grade at 6. And at dinner that night, she mentioned how funny it was that my feet were bigger than my older sister, who's 2 years older than I am. And my dad said, "Really? How much bigger?" And my mom started laughing and said, "Well, the shoe salesman just couldn't believe it." And so my dad said, "Hold up your hand." And I held my hand up and he realized that I have like monstrously big feet and hands, which is why I was like born to play the cello. And so he goes, "Hmm." And the next day he got me a little half-size cello. But studying with him was great because in some ways our personalities are very similar, but our playing style emotionally is very different. And so his big fear was that I would feel either overwhelmed by how good he was or competitive. And neither of us are competitive in any way. Like, both of us are very much focused in on whatever we do, we want to do it with excellence, and we want to do it the best that we can possibly do. But that has nothing to do with how anyone else is good. Hmm. Like, someone else being good doesn't make me less good.
Right.
Actually, it inspires me and makes me become greater. And we also believe talent is infinite and love is infinite. And so the more you love, the more talent you have, the more talent other people have. So it worked fantastically well. And it also, because of the way my father taught me, in that I didn't have lessons every week. I would have lessons really when I begged for one, because he figured I would know when I needed a lesson. Hmm. So it made me very self-motivated and very self-driven. And also, very early on, I looked to myself to solve the problems that I needed to solve, which was really fantastic training for being an artist for a lifetime, because at some point, it's all going to come down to you. And when you're out on stage, you're the one who's on stage, not your teacher. Right. And so you have to find what works best for you and the audience, you know. And I was very, very lucky that it worked out well that way. And I actually taught my son piano for a couple years as well. And then recently said, "Okay, now, even though I read music much better than you do, you're actually a better pianist than I am now, so we need to get you a real teacher."
Right. I definitely want to talk about that relationship as well, moving in that direction, mm-hmm. in your family tree. But thinking even back to your grandparents, I was curious to know, like, your grandmother, your father's mother, mm-hmm. you know, being a great pianist and a piano teacher, what kind of an influence did she have on you as a musician, if not like a, you know, a direct teacher, was there some influence that she had on you?
She did, actually. And we played a lot together my first year at Curtis because she lived in New Jersey. And so often I would go to New Jersey on the weekends and we'd play concerts together, which was super, super exciting. Wow. And there are times because, you know, Erica, the pianist in my trio, studied with my grandmother.
Right.
And that's how I met her when we were 12. And there are times when we play certain repertoire that it actually just brings tears to my eyes because it reminds me of the way my grandmother played. And I hear my grandmother in Erica's playing.
That actually was my next question about the grandmother being the teacher for your friend.
Yeah.
And then the one that you ended up joining forces with in this very successful chamber group, making music with such a longtime friend and one whom you've known since childhood. How does that inform your music-making process, your collaboration? How does that relationship, the personal relationship, factor in?
Enormously in chamber music. You know, before the Eroica Trio, my trio, there was not a single woman and certainly not an all-female chamber music group at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason why we were able to break that glass ceiling was because we had this unbelievably long history at such a young age. So, like, we were hitting it big and, you know, playing at Carnegie Hall at an age where, like, the Guarneri Quartet, when they got together, the cellist, David Sawyer, was 41.
Mm-hmm.
And we were out on the concert stage in our late teens.
Right.
But we'd already been playing together at that point for 7, 8, 9 years.
Right.
And so we had this amazing ability to be incredibly spontaneous on stage because we knew each other's personalities so well that just by the way there would be a hesitation on a note or even how someone takes a breath, we know exactly where they're going to go, and we can jump there and be there to catch them as if they have the melody, and vice versa. We rehearsed very intensely, but we also had an enormous amount of spontaneity and fluidity on stage because of that history behind, you know, every single choice that's made. Plus, you know, we also had such similar shaping forces, not just my grandmother, but also the coaches that we worked with. And so we were coming from the same tapestry,
right?
You know, but we're different enough personalities that there's nothing that seems homogenous about it. It seems like multifaceted, what we're creating, but it's coming from the same very rich tapestry and lineage.
And that is really, I would guess that's pretty rare, even in chamber music, to have someone who you click with, you could say artistically, like you said, the same tapestry, but also that you just click with personally.
Personally as well.
And then you can, and then that just really empowers the artistic process.
Yes, it does. And there, you know, for me also, performing, if you boil what I feel when I'm performing down to its essence, it's about love. Actually, I just feel an enormous amount of love coming through me and pouring into the audience and vice versa and going back up. So if you love your compatriots on stage, it's just going to intensify that music-making ability so much more. And there's a trust. So you know, something occurs to you as you're playing and it's a risk, but you know that they have your back. So you know, let's go for it because we could make something just extraordinary once in a lifetime and they'll catch me. I trust that they'll be there for me, you know, even though I've never gone in that direction. And they are. It's astonishing. Erica, especially, it's like she reads my mind. We just get each other in every way.
Well, that trio situation that you're in, obviously, shifting gears a little bit here, there's plenty of music that's been written for that combination of instruments. But then you, as an arranger, will take a lot of music that you feel probably should be arranged for your ensemble.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wondered if you could talk about the performer-arranger tradition.
I love
it. Benefits of arranging pieces for your own instrument.
I love it. I love it. And I mean, that was a huge tradition in the 19th century and the first, you know, probably 60 years of the 20th century. And now it seems to have died away. I find that sad because I think that, you know, Heifetz, when he would arrange these pieces for himself, he knew what sounded best on the violin. He knew what also could show off all his amazing abilities. And so he would create these really fantastic arrangements. But when you hire an arranger, It's more of a risk because they may not know, A, what sounds best on your instrument, and B, what you're capable of, you know. Right. And so they won't push the envelope as much as you might. And so even though sometimes occasionally we'll hire an arranger for a certain really complex piece, we then rearrange it once we get it and really add more to it. But I love arranging and composing as well. More the composing part I do with cadenzas and things like that. I really enjoy writing my own cadenzas. But I love the richness of finding the voice of each instrument and what it does best. Well, I was arranging the Swan by Saint-Saëns. So it was originally for cello and piano.
Right.
But I always thought how, you know, the Swan has these long up lines that go up the instrument on the cello. And I always thought, like, wouldn't it be neat if right when the cello started low and was about to ascend, if there was a violin that started high and descended and we crossed?
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I arranged the trio, I put that in.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, that's in that arrangement.
I just think it's just beautiful. I love that. It's just so heartbreaking but also just so satisfying about contrary motion and when you meet and then pass each other. There's something beautiful about the idea of ships passing in the night, you mm-hmm. know? Actually, I've always liked that phrase, ships passing in the night, and I think that's why I enjoy contrary motion so much in music. Because it reminds me of that. But it's super fun. And I know, like, when I was arranging two Piazzolla tangos for cello and orchestra, and the Lieber tango, which is one of his most successful tangos. And I found it interesting because, you know, he was basically compelled to write it by the regime that at the time was a fascist regime. And he was very much against that regime. But he had to do it, as Shostakovich had to write stuff under Stalin. And so he wrote it, like, under duress, but he tried to pour everything that he felt government and humanity should be into this tango, which I think is why it became his most popular. But when I was writing it for cello and orchestra, I thought, I sort of want a cadenza somewhere in here. I just feel like I want to start with something. And I thought, what I want to start with, and this again is like how I approach music, to try to find out everything I can behind that composition, the composer, what they were going through.
Right.
And so I decided I wanted to write almost like a prayer before it goes into, to express the longing of humanity for freedom. And then I was thinking, it's a very odd thought pattern, but I was thinking, you know, so much of Spanish music has a Moorish influence in it. And some of my favorite Spanish music has a really strong Moorish flavor. So I ended up writing this cadenza that sounds almost like a Middle Eastern prayer.
Right.
And then it pulls us in a really brilliant way into the tango.
The groove.
Yeah, right, the groove of the actual tango. And I really love that. And, you know, and it was fun. I actually talk about technology influencing our lives. I was writing it in my head, coming up with it on tour. I reused my iPhone on the voice memo because I kept forgetting exactly what I was doing in the cadenza. And I was like, oh, that's good. No, what was it I just did? You know? So I started taping myself on the voice memo. And then I actually taped the entire cadenza and then played through on the voice memo what I wanted the bass to come in, what I wanted them to do, what I wanted the violas to come in, what I wanted them to do, the whole thing. And then I emailed the voice memo to a copyist. And they generated the parts from my voice memo on my iPhone.
Oh, cool.
Which is so cool. Yeah.
That's cool.
It was like, and it saved me the time of having to go into the computer and then like write it all out and everything. It was great. I mean, I was like, wow, without the iPhone, I would have been in trouble. This would have taken a lot longer.
Yeah. So that's basically your arranging process is using some of those different technological
things,
advances,
yes,
yeah, and maybe some traditional things.
Yes, some traditional things. And, you know, sometimes I will sit down at the piano, but sometimes I won't at all. The Swan, I didn't actually ever sit down at the piano. It was all in my head. Actually, I ended up writing it on a boat in the Arabian Sea, actually on a piece of stationery. Oh, so messy. But, like, it was all in my head. And
were there ships passing in the night?
Yeah, you know, it was during the day.
Oh, okay.
But actually,
the idea was there.
The idea was there, right, exactly. Oh, well, the coolest thing was when we went through the Suez Canal, all the boats line up to take their turn to go through. It's wild. It's a really amazing sight to see. And I was at that point riding the swan, and then I stopped for a second actually and ran up on deck and watched what was happening, and then I went back down and finished the swan.
Huh. So that was part of your inspiration even as you were working
on that. Yeah, yeah. And it was, I think that's part of the reasons why I really was going for that whole, like, I really wanted to give the violin the opening melody at some point, so when it comes back, I gave it to the violin, you know. And it's you just take from whatever, I think as an artist, the moment that you stop being inspired by every single moment of your day is the moment that you stop growing. So for me, like every single thing that's happening to me at every moment, I'm looking at it and pulling from it something that inspires me to try to be greater. Actually, it's one of my son always says to me, "Mommy, you're so observant. I can't believe you noticed that thing up there," or whatever. But I'm always looking at stuff and going, "Wonder why that's there? What purpose does that serve?"
Yeah. Well, actually, that leads really well. I was going to bookend our discussion talking about your family again and talking about your son. I was curious, how does your expertise as a musician shape the way you encourage your son's musical activities? Now, you said you started teaching him at first, mm-hmm. but I would imagine even the moment he started with a different teacher, you're still inspiring him or influencing him in various ways because you're a musician yourself.
Yes.
How does that work?
There's two things that I do. Actually, I am having him now take his lessons and practice right now, not in our house, but actually at the trio studio, so that I'm not hovering over him, because I want him to find the space that he needs to create his own persona and as an artist. And I know that his personality is not exactly the same as mine. Like for me, with my father, it never occurred to me to not go in my own direction, even though my father was there. I liked the fact that he would be walking by my open practice room and go flat, you know, or sharp or out of tune, you know,
right.
Or you're rushing or whatever. I liked that because I was like, great, move on, you know. But I know my son is a little bit, he's less robust in that direction. So I decided like a few months ago to give him the space to go in his own direction. But what I do say to him is, number one, whatever you do, I never care if you make mistakes. The only thing that I care about is that, did you try your hardest?
Mm-hmm.
And if you, at the end of the day, can't say that you tried your hardest, then tomorrow, make it your number one priority that you're going to try your hardest at whatever you do. And then the other thing is to, whenever, like, he has a very strong emotion, we'll talk about it, and then I'll say, remember this and use it the next time you play the piano.
Right, and he's 11. I should mm-hmm. have mentioned that too, right?
Yeah.
He's 11 years old, so he's to that point where he can start
a lot of hormones
thinking about like his emotional contribution to what he's doing, starting to notice those things artistically.
Right, exactly. And the other thing was that he loves tangos so much, and like every time he hears me play Lieber tango, he's like, I want to play the cello. I want to play the cello. And so when I chose a teacher, I actually chose an Argentinian tango pianist as his teacher because I thought that would be, who has exactly the same first name as my son. so that I thought it would be really, that would help fuel that excitement and fun, and they could work on tangos together as well, and the tango form and the kind of touch that you use and the rhythmic propulsion that tangos have. I took him on stage with me on a concert. You know, he said something about, I'm a little worried that I'm going to make a mistake. And I said, it's very possible because we're human, but there's no such thing as a mistake on stage. Everything that happens on stage is an opportunity to stretch as for yourself, but it's also an opportunity to bond with the audience. So I said, you know, you're on stage with me. Nothing bad can happen because no matter what happens, we're going to turn it into something beautiful.
Hmm.
So just remember that and just let yourself go. And then he played so, we had two concerts I had him play with me, and it was shockingly beautiful. I couldn't believe it. It actually made tears come to my eyes.
So you're, because that's really interesting, I think, for parents who have children in music lessons, whether they're musical or not musical. I mean, here you are. He's not playing the instrument you play,
mm-hmm.
but as a musician and as an artist, you understand the musical process. So even though it's a different instrument, you're helping him find his way artistically, like, okay, I can see where you have different needs than what I had,
mm-hmm.
and that type of thing. So there's a lot of overlap between like what you did as a cellist and what he's doing as a pianist, and you're recognizing that as his mother, being able to help him with that.
Well, I think that, you know, look, some of the biggest things that I learned from artists were not from classical artists. Like, literally, I went to this concert by Prince at Radio City Music Hall about 3 weeks before I was supposed to play at the Hollywood Bowl for the first time. And Radio City Music Hall has a huge stage. It seats about 5,000. And Prince is teeny tiny.
Sure.
You know, he's like probably 6 inches shorter than I am. And as slender, if not more slender. And he just dominated that stage. It was unbelievable. And the entire concert, that's what I was soaking up. As much as I liked his music making as well, I think he's massively talented. What I was soaking up was, how did he dominate that stage? How did he fill it with his charisma and his personality? And so then before I walked out on Hollywood Bowl stage for 15,000 people, I thought of Prince.
Right.
And I just filled up my body with as much of the joy and passion and power that I could. And I walked out and just boom, pushed out into the audience. And I felt like I filled that stage. And in fact, most of the time, people often say to me when they see me at receptions after the concert, they're like, oh, you're so small. You seem so much bigger on stage.
Like you said, you're pulling artistic ideas from really everything in
life,
but especially music, and not just the kind of music
that
you're playing.
Play. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Off and on, I'll play in improv groups that are not classically based. But I will pull classical elements into my improvisation, of course. And I find that every time I do that, I come back to particularly Baroque music, but also Latin music, with a whole fresh new idea of how, of ornamenting, and of just of the aliveness of the music, that it's a living, breathing thing. Even though it may have been written 200, 300 years ago, it's a living, breathing thing right this second. So I find that very, really helpful.
That's awesome. And that's what, those are the kinds of things you're able to help your son with as well, just helping him draw influences from just everything that you take in culturally, artistically, just everyday life.
And I worry about this with the kids of that generation, because they're on their phones and their iPads and their games nonstop. They're not awake to the world around them, which is so rich. And such an amazing learning experience. Every single day, there are just a myriad of things that you can learn from and grow greater. And it's sort of, I think, one's responsibility to do that, to become as great as one can be. You're given this vessel, and it is your responsibility to cherish it and to take care of it. And that means, you know, being healthy and not eating junk food all day. But it also means using every moment of your life to become greater and reflect the glory more intensely. I also think that at that age, it's such an amazing age that my son is at, 11, 12, 13. And I always notice this when I'm teaching. I love how that's that moment that most young students suddenly become aware that they can infuse the music with their own emotions. And it's such a cathartic thing. Also, if you're going through a hard time, you put it into the music. And it's, you know, because music is one of those magical things that you can take something, an experience that was maybe very ugly, and through the process of pouring it into your music, you transmute it into something beautiful that uplifts everyone and makes everyone realize we're all together. We're not alone in the universe, you know? And I think that's one of the most basic human condition, is that feeling of being alone in the universe. And music and live performance negates that. It makes you all become aware of how we are all together, and you're never alone, and you're always surrounded by this beauty. When I'm teaching, I'm like, you know, so they'll come in, they'll seem a little upset, and I'll say, you know, what's going on? And so it's really important to know what's going on in your students' lives, whereas the trio also talks about what's going on in our lives. So we say, use it here, you know. And then that moment when a student takes some experience and suddenly figures out, you know, through help from their teacher or whatever, to how to channel it into the music, and then it transforms the music, and suddenly it's alive, and you see their faces just light up.
Right.
And you go, yes, that's it. You know, and often I say, look, it's also just as long as you have that intent, you don't have to actually do anything different with your fingers, but the intent is there, and it will come through, you know, and it does.
That's
it's very compelling, you know.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, this has been Awesome, fascinating. Thank you so much for sharing all your thoughts with us today.
It's my pleasure.
You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we are discussing the influential female musicians of history in an episode I've titled Great Women of Music. We are particularly exploring great female composers of history. Now let's have our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people to music. This episode today has been about the great women of music, but the subtext has really been about how music is a human activity, something for both genders. In that vein, let's explore the benefits of a co-educational music classroom. Our college and auditorium's namesake, Herbert W. Armstrong, was a great educator of the 20th century who founded Ambassador College, which had three campuses at one point. Mr. Armstrong felt it was important to those schools' curriculum that males and females learn together. He wrote this in his autobiography about his intent for Ambassador. "Most effective development of character, personality, poise, and true culture," he said, "is better achieved by social contact of both sexes." Because of this, he said, it became plain that the college must be co-educational. A co-educational environment certainly contributes to development in true culture, as Mr. Armstrong wrote, and especially as pertains to the field of music. He founded the first Ambassador College campus in the late 1940s, and this wasn't long after American schools had just started becoming co-educational. The co-educational aspect of music in the classroom had become possible in the mid-19th century United States with the rise of co-educational schools. Oberlin College in Oberlin, Ohio, was established in 1833 as the first co-educational institution in the United States. In 1865, Oberlin established its Conservatory of Music, not only one of the most respected music schools in the country, but the first to offer co-educational opportunities in a music classroom. Having males and females together in a vocal ensemble-type situation teaches some of the basic lessons of how male and female voices can blend in the traditional choral sense, and it can teach some of the basics of four-part harmony, since the pitches of most chords are often best divided into four parts. One Cambridge professor believes that mixing boys and girls at a young age is important even from a non-musical standpoint because it helps them learn about one another. Generally speaking, boys participate more in classroom discussions through interaction with girls, and girls are more willing to take risks in problem solving when they interact with boys, he found. Boys and girls learning together is also important because they learn how to express themselves comfortably in the presence of the opposite sex. This holds especially true in choir settings, obviously. Boys and girls learning together in a choral ensemble can help each other learn to express themselves more comfortably. As a music educator myself, in both a one-on-one and classroom environment, I try to reinforce with all of my students that music is a human activity. All the wonderful things there are to learn from it can be enjoyed by both genders. In some obvious cases, the physical differences in their genders require certain considerations, particularly in relation to their voices. Differences in vocal ranges mean they have to sing different parts, obviously. Though there may be certain reasons and benefits to have all female or all male vocal ensembles to highlight the particular qualities of each gender's vocal abilities, the activity of singing in general, for instance, should never be considered just for one gender or the other. This has been Classroom Corner. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we have been discussing the influential female musicians of history in an episode I've titled Great Women of Music. We have particularly examined the great female composers of history. Finally, let's have our dessert for today's program, where we hear an example from the popular or folk tradition to end the episode. We've been talking about great women of music today, and so let's listen to a unique all-female folk ensemble. This is a recording of the Bulgarian Women's Choir from the early 1990s. It was at this time that the lifting of the so-called Iron Curtain made possible certain cultural exports from Eastern Europe. Listen to all the vocal colors and ranges that these women are able to accomplish. This is Kaval Sviri, performed by the Bulgarian women's ensemble known as Ensemble Trakia. You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.